You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're rejoining us. And happy hump day Wednesday. Well, it's been an afternoon of breaking news, and we've got a great guest joining us to talk about some of that breaking news. We're joined this half hour by State Senator Chris Larson of the Senate Fighting District 7. Welcome, Senator Larson. A bit of a kerfuffle over the last hour or so about whether or not Governor Evers is running for re-election. Some sources saying he's going to announce that he's not running for a third term, and his spokesperson then responding on X within the last, I don't know, handful of minutes that, that's not an actual thing. Your reactions to all the hubbub, sir?
Yeah, I people have been talking about this for quite a while, but I guess we'll find out whenever they make an announcement. For our part, I would hope that Tony Evers does read the room and is ready to pass the baton to the next generation to be able to make sure that we actually have people who are ready to fight for our state.
So let's talk about that, Senator. You were harshly critical of the governor's budget. Tell us about some of those reasons why you were critical of the governor's budget, which, again, not really the governor's budget when we're playing on a Republican playing field.
Yeah, I mean, look, we have a different legislature than we had before. We're within two seats in the Senate. We're within five seats in the House. And so for us, you also have a Democratic governor. And so you would hope that, especially when it became clear that they needed to have Democratic votes to be able to pass this, that the first Democratic vote was going to have quite a price tag associated with it about what it would get that first Democratic vote versus the last Republican vote. You think of the distance between where Republicans are at nationally and where Democrats are at nationally, and how absolutely bonkers the Republicans are of rescinding money for National Public Radio, of sending an armed masked battalion out into cities where there's peaceful protesters and where they want to pull away health care away from people who rightfully deserve it. So the first Democratic vote should have a heavy price tag associated with it. That should have included Medicaid expansion, especially when you have a Democratic governor who could stand there and say, we are not going to do something unless it benefits the people. You could have had matching special education reimbursement to make sure that they're getting 90% reimbursement the same way private vouchers are getting them and have been getting it for years. They were not signing the budget unless that's in there. Criminal justice reform is a huge one. Making sure that our child care centers are going to be taken care of so that parents can actually continue to work and that we don't have one quarter of the child care centers shutting down as is being predicted. Any one of those things. Or more, right? Should have been a red line in this budget. Instead, we catered to Republicans and what their red lines were, and none of those things were ever even on the table. Tony Evers made very clear to the Democrats that he would sign whatever budget was put in front of him. If it was good or if it was bad, he wanted to get a budget done. That's what he did the last budget. That's what he did the budget before that. And you know what? Maybe in different times, in normal times, that would have been fine. But right now, the working people of the state of Wisconsin are under siege, and we need to have a fighter. I just wish the governor would have done that. So
let me just hop in and ask very briefly. Let me just ask very briefly. Doesn't some of the criticism rely on the assumption that Republicans would blink? They don't have to blink. Was there an analysis for you of downside risk in the interim period? Are those things reasonably all actually achievable when you have a legislature that is correctly, as you point out, by much smaller margins, still controlled by Republicans?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think it benefits us to give up in advance by not trying, right? And I think we're rewarding their intransigence by saying that they are refusing, like, and we have used cynicism as an excuse to be able to say, well, they would never go for this. Well, why? Why are we not talking about expanding Badger Care, expanding Medicaid to 133% of poverty, because it would get 90% match from the federal government? It would net us $750 million.
And Senator, I won't disagree with you with any of those points, and I don't think the governor would either. But the question is that actually possible given a Republican-controlled legislature? And right. If we're going to criticize the budget, how do we then unify to beat Republicans, the candidates coming out for the governor's race from the Republican side, and actually take control of the legislature in 26, right? Like, what is actually possible? Because I don't think I've heard Tony Evers say he doesn't want any of those things that you just articulated.
Well, I mean, he put them in his budget, and then that was it. I don't think he made the stump around the state saying that this is what we absolutely need to have and making the case, which, by the way, these are wildly popular things. And this isn't just a blue state or a red state or a purple state. This has happened in states across the country. All but 10 states have expanded Medicaid because it's the right thing to do.
And of course it is. But again, my question is about the political realities of the budget itself and the time pressures and what happens with no budget when the big brutal bill gets passed and adopted. What happens when some of those funding sources runs out? How long can we withstand no budget or a veto or a standoff with no budget? And who ends up paying the price in the interim? Do you think Republicans blink if we get into, frankly, a game of chicken with them over the budget?
Well, we blinked. I mean, we blinked immediately. So, like,
That's an argument. I mean, the other argument is you get the best deal you can when you don't control the legislature. And I think the question that you're pointing correctly to, Senator, is what was actually in the realm of possibility? What was achievable given the voting margins, right? And again, I agree with absolutely everything you're saying on the substantive merits of all of these issues.
Yeah, and I would say, look, the budget started when he ended up introducing it back in February. And so you had February to talk about it. You had March to talk about it, April, May. And it was only in June that we actually got to the point where there was any discussion about whether Democrats' votes would be required. And we knew from the beginning that they were going to need Democratic votes. But it was only the last week that they finally brought Democrats into the room. And they basically said, look, these are the things that are off the table. And then that timeline, right, then the clock is ticking. You have the theatrics of, like, the ticking clock trying to get things
the
done
urgency.
Before the end of the... Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about the necessity of Democratic votes. Had Republicans remained completely unified, they wouldn't have needed Democratic votes. Moreover, haven't Republicans in the last few years, maybe I'll say a decade within the state and certainly under the MAGA regime and the craziness of Trump, been an incredibly unified party? So until Voss and other Republican leaders couldn't make the votes tally, it wasn't certain that they were going to need Democratic votes to pass the budget, was it?
No, it was clear on the Republican side and the Senate for sure. You're right, on the Assembly side, Robin Voss has some type of trance that he has all these Republicans
the
in.
Pied Piper.
Yeah, I don't know what the heck's going on there. But he literally was accounting for their votes through fear and intimidation. In the Senate, that was not the case. Right, you had a number of folks who said up front, Chris Kapanga and Steve Nass, who were able to say that we are not going to be voting for this. You knew that they were going to need votes, and the margin was so close. And so we knew that way, way, way in advance. And frankly, that wasn't just me talking about it. It was a lot of Democrats talking about it. And it was only at the very end that they finally realized, okay, we need to bring you into the room. And Maggie, that was because the Republicans were counting on Tony Evers turning Democratic votes over. And luckily, our leader, Dianne Heseltine, said we are not going to be offering up any votes unless we're in the room negotiating. And again, those conversations unfortunately didn't start until a week before the budget passed. And I think like there was a huge mistake if we would have had a governor who was willing to work with us in partnership and be able to say, let's get the best deal that we can for the people in the state of Wisconsin, then it would have been a very different conversation about how we get to these things that are frankly wildly popular. Everything that I said is wildly popular publicly. And instead, we're rewarding Republicans for their cynicism and their inability to actually care and govern and do things that are actually helping the people. And
yeah, this has been a persistent problem. Granted, with the new maps, the margins reduce. My question to you, Senator, is if Tony Evers runs again, does the criticism help or hurt the chances of Democrats to hold the state house in the next election cycle? How do we work through the differences within our party and legitimately talk about some of those shortcomings and still maintain a united front when it comes to defeating the MAGA regime here in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, we'll take a step back. And I think it's important to talk about what democratic rule would actually look like, what our priorities are. And I think we could have been laying those things out. You know, the governor put out his budget and there's a lot of things in there which gives us something to rally around. But I think if we're going to be making the case of the public, people are talking about us getting a trifecta like it's a given, like it's an automatic.
Right.
There's stuff happening now.
Far from it,
right now. Right. The Justice Department is talking about trying to be able to get the voter rolls for the state of Wisconsin and other states. Let's not forget that this is not just some normal president. This is a guy who denied the election results of the 2020 election and sent a violent mob onto the Capitol to try and overturn the results of it. He only embraces the results when they go his way. He is not somebody who is for free and fair elections. So we have to really make the case to the public about that. But then beyond that, we need to say how we're going to make people's lives better and show that we're actually fighting for them. And that starts.
Sorry, Senator, I want to just jump in here because I certainly have no disagreement about all of the havoc and threat that MAGA and Donald Trump pose. All those things are true. And yet, I think the question is, how do we engage in real policy debate within the Democratic Party, specifically the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and yet not weaken the party, not weaken candidates? Can you stick around and come back on the other side? Because I'd love to continue this discussion.
Yeah, happy to.
Awesome. Yeah, We've got Senator Chris Larson of Fighting Senate District 7 with us. We're talking about the hard stuff of politics. When we agree about the most important stuff, but have some disagreement about how to get to the political wins, what do we do about that? We continue our discussion with the senator on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. It is Hump Day Wednesday here on the Maggie Dawn Show. And there's been a lot of action here in Wisconsin state politics in recent days. Topic du jour is Tony Evers running for re-election. We got State Senator Chris Larson with us of Senate District 7. He voted against the biennial budget. We've been exploring how to have real policy, perhaps departure points and disagreements within the Democratic Party, and yet not weaken the party, and yet understand that coming together and unifying to defeat what are existential threats from Donald Trump and the MAGA regime, you know, that's a challenge. In fact, President Obama at a fundraiser last Friday pointed to exactly this very challenge that we face. He said this: there has been some argument between the left of the party and people who are promoting the quote unquote abundance agenda. Those things are not contradictory. We have to deliver for people and make their lives bigger, better. You got to figure out how to do it. Right now, what we need is courage. Democrats got to toughen up. He sort of lambasted the navel gazing, the idea of perfect versus the possible. Senator Larson, Listen, I think there's, in every budget, there's going to be criticisms to be made. It is difficult. The governor has to win election, and he requires voters that may be more centrist. You have a very safe blue district. There's arguably less political risk that for you than there would be for someone that's running for statewide race. How do we bridge the gulf, still have these good faith arguments, policy debates within the big tent of Democrats, and not weaken the party?
I reject the premise of the question, right? I think we have to have these debates, and if we're not, we're never going to get to the best possible solution, right? Like, conflict yields some type of a result, and especially now, there should be some conflict because people have been getting screwed over for way too long. And I think that sometimes there's this tendency to view like the what's politically possible as like a flat two-dimensional board where it's like, here's the thing on the left, here's the thing on the right, and it just moves like, you know, one dot around it. And it's like, well, where does it end up? Is it in the middle? Is it towards the left? And the reality is these things are policies that frankly, in many cases, that are wildly publicly popular. And Republicans, who are more beholden to the rich in corporations than Democrats are, they end up saying and labeling those things as being extreme, as being impossible, and some things that we could never do. But at the same time, if you gaze over their shoulders and look in other states, they're already happening. Or if we dare to look beyond our own borders, these are things that are happening in many, many other countries. Things like having access to paid family leave, right? Being able to take time off after you have a baby. Making sure that public education is a right and that we are actually enshrining it in our Constitution as we have, but actually backing it up with funding so that a child now is not worth less than they were 18 years ago, we have in the state of Wisconsin, $3,000. And I think you have to make those cases publicly to be able to say, this is, if they are voting for this, this is what they are voting for. And I think if there's just a tendency to count noses and to count heads and to be able to say, well, you know what, do we really want to go to the mat and fight for this? Or do we just want to say, okay, we're going to give in and maybe we'll fight somewhere down the road? My question is when, if not now, when are we going to fight? Because it has been 18 years. I care so much about public education because it is the bedrock on which democracy is built. It gives access to folks to knowledge that they can use to be able to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I as a sort of poster child for the Wisconsin educational system and a proud graduate of Rufus King High School for the College Bound, I'm absolutely with you on all of the substance of the things that you're talking about. Specifically, here's what I completely agree with when it comes to political frames. Democrats have far too long have been reactive to the Republican frame of political dialogue. That's what's got to change. But when does the criticism become itself a weakness? When do we set that aside, still have those debates internally, and then, and frankly, as an economist, what I think of is downside risk of harm. Right? Like the risk of harm if a Republican becomes governor in this state is frankly existential for some communities. When do we have to set the differences aside, if ever, Senator? We got about a minute.
Yeah, no, and in this case, I would say, look, I've privately criticized the governor for years and been pushing for a better budget. I have encouraged him to veto it and say, look, we cannot afford this. He, in this budget, did not fight for the 90% reimbursement, and even that, he condemned Jill Underly when she introduced her budget that did have that in there, which, why not push for that, right? He was trying to be more practical with 60, settled at 45, and he gave, for the first time since the year 2010, $0 in general aid for our public schools, which means that they're going to have less. And I get the argument of saying compromise for compromise sake, because then we can get reelected. But like,
let me be clear. That is not at all what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that the risk of harm to many communities is so existential that if the perfect is not in fact possible, When do we step back from the brink? Senator Larson, I hope we can continue what I think is the most important political discussion of our time. Senator, let me ask you this last question. Are you running for governor?
Look, what happens with the governor here? I am not thrilled with what he is doing, and I think that there's a lot of qualified people who are going to step forward. We can frankly have this debate in the public, but doing it behind closed doors and pretending that everything's fine is netting us further and further behind as a state. And it's the reason why it's not just me, but other people are coming out and saying, this is the problem.
We got to leave it right there. Thank you to Senator Chris Larson of the 7th Senate District. I'll be right back here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Big, big thanks to State Senator Chris Larson from Senate District 7 for engaging in a discussion, answering my questions about, hey, we got a big tent Democratic Party here. How do we bring us all together? There's always going to be differences in viewpoint, and trying to explore the tension points that arise when folks, perhaps some would argue like the senator, are running in very, very royal blue districts, have safe seats, and frankly, a pretty safe perch from which to criticize statewide elected officers. Now, as I said to the senator, I agree substantively with every point he was making. We should be able to do so much better for Wisconsinites than we have been able to do. And I completely agree with the senator that I think Democrats for far too long have accepted the political debate framework that Republicans have set for us. We've been far too reactive. If you've been listening to me for a while, you've probably heard this theme. And the economic injustice of it all, the failure to promote working families, the failure to respect the hardworking ethic of families across Wisconsin and the middle class in this country. Yeah, Democrats haven't done enough. If you've listened to me for a while, you've heard me quote this statistic many, many times. $51 trillion. By the way, it's a much bigger number now after the big, brutal bill. $51 trillion has been robbed, taken, stolen, if you will, from families that make less than $200,000 a year, which sounds like a big number, but less than $200,000 a year. Who's been stealing that? That $51 trillion plus, thank you to Donald Trump and MAGA, $51 trillion, who's been stealing that from families that earn less than $200,000 a year? Folks that make $1 million a year or more. That is the total amount of wealth stolen by those people. Folks whose families earn $1 million or more a year. That's the total amount that's been stolen from families making less than $200,000 since 1981. Our tax code's rigged. And Donald Trump is just making it all so much worse. So there's so much to unite us. How do we bring the party together? Because, as we all know, lives and livelihoods are at stake. So again, thanks so much to Senator Chris Larson. Can't wait to continue that discussion with him in the future. Also, maybe we broke a little news here on Civic Media. I asked the senator, hey, are you going to be running for governor? Are you going to put your hat in the ring? And he didn't say no, didn't say yes either, but definitely didn't say no. Today we began our conversation this afternoon with an economist. And one of the themes that and important points that I wanted to talk to him about was the independence of the Federal Reserve. Now, it sounds wonky. It sounds like, oh, what do I care about the Fed? I don't do macroeconomics, monetary policy, fiscal policy, yawn. But what I and Dr. Bivens were trying to explore is the fact that an independent Federal Reserve with a chairman or chairwoman that is not beholden to the political whims of a president is essential. Now, I have made an argument for a long time that since 1976 and Buckley v. Vallejo made worse with Citizens United, we have had this overwhelmingly corrupting influence of big money in politics. And like Senator Larson said, I don't care who's polling, 80 plus percent of us hate that. 80 plus percent of us, no matter what party we vote for or belong to or whether or not we like politics or are into it, 80 plus percent of us think we should be able to legislate money in politics, that we should get money out of politics. And yet, our Supreme Court has said, no. Money is speech. Corporations are people. This is all fine. So with the money in politics, what we've seen is that politicians, ever more so in most recent elections, and especially on the right, are frankly being bought by billionaires and 100 millionaires. Since when was it ever a good political idea to win office and then have on your inaugural stage with you a bunch of frickin' billionaires? Like, since when is that appealing to regular Americans? I don't know, but apparently Donald Trump thinks it is because he did it. All of that points to this. If we have a politicized federal bank, if you think the economy hasn't been working for you to date, if you think Democrats should be doing more, here's what I have to say to you. If we politicize the Fed, what has been not fair for middle class and working people to date will get so very much worse. And what has Donald Trump been talking about and threatening to do for the last, I don't know, few months, basically since he was inaugurated? He talks smack about the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell all the time. And over the last week, they have been trumping up, pun intended, a completely bogus basis, pretext, if you will, fig leaf, that would provide, quote, the for cause reason to fire Jerome Powell. And this very idea, by the way, the reason, oh, yes, we can fire him and fire him for cause. And the reason that they're going down this road and trumping up a reason to fire him and saying it's for cause, it's for malfeasance, is because of the Supreme Court in a completely unrelated case earlier this year basically said, there are plenty of people Donald Trump can fire because they're not loyalists and they won't bend the knee, but not the Federal Reserve chair. They already signaled that. So Donald Trump and his lackeys know they have to have an actual for-cause reason to fire the chair. So they're making one up. The Federal Reserve building in Washington, D.C. is over 100 years old. It's got asbestos and leaky pipes and mold. I mean, it's a freaking disaster. And they started an incredibly expensive renovation back in 2021. Now, there may be some of you that live in houses that are over 100 years old. There may be some of you that have attempted to renovate those houses. And I'm sure any of you that fall into that particular category have discovered that whatever your budget is for a 100-plus-year-old house renovation, yeah, it ends up costing you way more than that. So too for the 100-plus-year-old Federal Reserve building in Washington, D.C. And that is the trumped-up basis under which Donald Trump and his lackeys are attempting to fire the Federal Reserve chair. And in fact, Scott Hassett said exactly that on one of the Sunday talk shows just this past weekend. Let's take a listen.
I think that whether the president decides to push down that road or not is going to depend a lot on the answers that we get to the questions that Russ Vogt sent to the Fed. The bottom line is that this is the most expensive project in D.C. history, $2.5 billion with a $700 billion cost overrun. To put that in perspective, the cost overrun for this Federal Reserve project is about the same size as the second biggest building overhaul in American history, which was the FBI building. And so the Fed has a lot to answer for. And the bottom line is that there's a key statutory problem. In 1913, when we founded the Fed, the U.S. was under a gold standard. So it was never envisioned by the people that voted for the construction of the Fed that we currently see, that the Fed could print money and toss it around willy-nilly because they had to have the gold to do what they're doing. And they're unbounded right now.
Right.
I'm not going to have a discussion about the gold standard, but suffice it to say, basically all good faith mainstream economists think what he just said is really stupid. Again, that's a pretty wonky debate for a different day. But what he's trying to say is that the Fed renovation project, admittedly massive cost overruns, is somehow fraudulent and amounts to significant
Hey, Maggie Don fans, this is Jacob here at our fantastic Civic Media Studios here in Racine. Crazy weather we've got out there, huh? Some may say the weather is so bad, in fact, that you might even have a host drop out from your internet connection in the middle of a program. Sounds unprecedented, but folks, if you're in this business as long as I have been, these things happen. We're going to try to get Maggie right back with you as soon as possible. It should just be about 30 seconds here.
Hello, everybody. I am back. So to pick up where we left off, they're inventing a bogus reason to try to provide an excuse to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell. And it got worse today. President Trump apparently, this is according to reporting by the New York Times earlier today, President Trump apparently showed a draft termination letter during a meeting, showed it off to a bunch of House Republicans in a meeting in the Oval Office, and basically like went around the room and polled the Republicans about whether or not he should do it. I'm sorry. The most important central banker in the world, and Donald Trump is asking people who are deathly afraid of being primaried by the MAGA regime, hey, should I fire this guy that I talk smack about like virtually every single day? And oh, by the way, just in case you forgot, the guy that appointed Jerome Powell, yeah, his name is Donald Trump. This is Trump's pick. Joe Biden just left him in place. And the weird thing about this was that these House Republicans, about a dozen of them, they were there to talk about AI legislation and their concerns about both AI and crypto. No. I'm really the small infant is distracted by the shiny object, and he wants to talk about Jerome Powell because he hates the guy so much. It's pretty bananas. And in fact, it turns out that this letter was drafted by a guy named William Pulte. And no, I had never heard of him either. He is the director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. And to make matters all the more worse, conspiracy theorist and Florida congressional representative Anna Paulina Luna told reporters today that absolutely 100% Jerome Powell is getting fired. Make no mistake, folks, a politicized Fed will make an already rigged economy even worse for regular people. We're going to take care of a little business, hopefully get that weather under control, and come back with Over the Hump and Trump here on the Maggie Don Show. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. Happy to arrive here with each and every one of you. We're at the last segment of the afternoon. Here on Hump Day Wednesday on the Civic Media Radio Network, as many of you who have been tuning into this program for a little bit know, on Wednesdays, sometimes I like to give us maybe a little bit of inspiration and a little bit of hope. And I was frankly nearly brought to tears when I stumbled across a young man's, I guess, plea, suggestions for all of us about how to maintain our energy and some of our psychic safety in these very, very dark and troubling times, weather notwithstanding. Let's take a listen. I don't know who this young man is. I couldn't quite find his name, but let's take a listen to what he has to say to all of us.
You ever notice how the world drains the people who feel the deepest, the ones with soft hearts that carry the heaviest loads, not because they're weak, but because they refuse to become what hurt them? See, what we don't talk about enough is the emotional tax of being good in a selfish world. You show up with love, they show up with agendas. You give to build, they take to survive. It's like being fluent in a language that no one wants to understand anymore. You speak soul, they speak convenience. And then you're left wondering, is there something wrong with me? No, there's something right with you. But right doesn't always feel rewarding at first. The truth is having a good heart comes with consequences. You will be underestimated. You will be misused. You will be overlooked by people who confuse your peace with passivity. But here's the real gut check. Stop expecting people with shallow intentions to handle your heart like it's sacred. It's not their job to protect it. It's your job to guard it without guilt. So no, don't stop loving. Don't stop caring. But stop letting your love be the lesson for people who refuse to learn.
I just thought it was an incredibly good encapsulation of, I think, sometimes how we all feel about what's going on in the world. Like, you try, you give, and almost like the state's biennial budget, you know, maybe we just barely move the needle, and you sometimes want to ask yourself, what am I doing all this fighting for? So I hope you took some energy from that this afternoon. I certainly did when I came across it. And I'll continue to try to figure out what young man said that, because I'd like to give him some source credit for that one. But hearing that made me think about a number of conversations I've had with friends and family over the last 3 to 4 years when they have faced pretty big life decisions, some of them career decisions. And what we have talked through, I can best summarize as a life audit. And what I mean by that is looking at yourself and how you spend your time every day and who you spend your time with, what you're reading, what you're consuming, and is it bringing you joy? Is it bringing you peace? Is it speaking to your values? And don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't seek out opinions that are different from yours or new and challenging information. Of course we should do that. But there are vehicles for those challenging different opinions that are more productive than others, more respectful than others. And perhaps most importantly, I've had so many conversations with people about their professions, and is their profession actually speaking to their values? And I think as we all go through our lives, we have opportunities to take stock, and our ability to see these things much more clearly increases, I hope, with age. I know that I became a lawyer because in some small way I wanted to positively impact the world. And I remember when I came out of law school, boy, I thought I knew all the answers. And I think a lot of people these days will tell us they know all the answers. But the reality is that they don't. But there is a big difference between someone who operates in good faith and who is someone who nurtures and cares and wants good things for other people, who wants to treat people with dignity and respect, no matter what their differences are, and someone who's simply looking out for themselves. So my thoughts for you this afternoon are, with all that has been going on, especially this dark news, this debate about Jeffrey Epstein and what to do here, please, I hope that you have moments where you can reflect, you can do a life audit, and really look squarely at whether or not who you spend your time with, what your work, your profession might be, is bringing you joy, is affirming your values. And yes, I fully understand that folks that have the ability to do that and to try to pick jobs that affirm their values and speak to what brings them joy, that that is a privilege. So I hope that you have that privilege. And I hope and thank you for sharing some of your day with me. And I hope it's brought you a bit of joy and peace and lit you up a little bit, because I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being here with me. I'll be back tomorrow. We got Dr. Lyerly joining us again. We're going to have another great conversation. We keep it spicy, but always friendly here on The Maggie Dawn Show. Thanks for being here with me. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it's always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.